Chapter 1. Balkan Europe. 1. The European War and After. Observe now your own epoch of history as it appears to the last men. Long before the human spirit awoke to clear cognizance of the world and itself, it sometimes stirred in its sleep, opened bewildered eyes, and slept again. One of these moments of precocious experience embraces the whole struggle of the first men, from savagery towards civilization. Within that moment, you stand almost in the very instant when the species attains its zenith. Scarcely at all beyond your own day is this early culture to be seen progressing, and already in your time the mentality of the race shows signs of decline. The first, and some would say the greatest achievement of your own Western culture, was the conceiving of two ideals of conduct, both essential to the spirit's well-being. Socrates, delighting in the truth for its own sake, and not merely for practical ends, glorified unbiased thinking, honesty of mind and speech. Jesus, delighting in the actual human persons around him, and in that flavour of divinity which for him pervaded the world, stood for unselfish love of neighbours and of God. Socrates woke to the ideal of dispassionate intelligence, Jesus to the ideal of passionate yet self-oblivious worship. Socrates urged intellectual integrity, Jesus integrity of will. Each, of course, though starting with a different emphasis, involved the other. Unfortunately, both these ideals demanded of the human brain a degree of vitality and coherence of which the nervous system of the first men was never really capable. For many centuries, these twin stars enticed the more precociously human of human animals in vain. And the failure to put these ideals in practice helped to engender in the race a cynical lassitude which was one cause of its decay. There were other causes. The peoples from whom sprang Socrates and Jesus were also among the first to conceive admiration for fate. In Greek tragic art and Hebrew worship of divine law, as also in the Indian resignation, man experienced at first, very obscurely, that vision of an alien and supernal beauty, which was to exalt and perplex him again and again throughout his whole career. The conflict between this worship and the intransigent loyalty to life, embattled against death, proved insoluble. And though few individuals were ever clearly conscious of the issue, the first human species was again and again unwittingly hampered in its spiritual development by this supreme perplexity. While man was being whipped and enticed by these precocious experiences, the actual social constitution of his world kept changing so rapidly through increased mastery over physical energy that his primitive nature could no longer cope with the complexity of his environment. Animals that were fashioned for hunting and fighting in the wild were suddenly called upon to be citizens, and moreover, citizens of a world community. At the same time, they found themselves possessed of certain very dangerous powers which their petty minds were not fit to use. Man struggled, but, as you shall hear, he broke under the strain. The European War, called at the time the War to End War, was the first and least destructive of those world conflicts which display so tragically the incompetence of the first men to control their own nature. At the outset, a tangle of motives, some honourable and some disreputable, ignited a conflict for which both antagonists were all too well prepared, though neither seriously intended it. A real difference of temperament between Latin France and Nordic Germany, combined with a superficial rivalry between Germany and England, and a number of stupidly brutal gestures on the part of the German government and military command to divide the world into two camps, yet in such a manner that it is impossible to find any difference of principle between them. During the struggle, each party was convinced that it alone stood for civilization, but in fact both succumbed now and again to impulses of sheer brutality, and both achieved acts not merely of heroism, but of generosity unusual among the first men. For conduct which to clear a mind seems merely sane was in those days to be performed only by rare vision and self-mastery. As the months of agony advanced, there was bred in the warring peoples a genuine and even passionate will for peace and a united world. Out of the conflict of the tribes arose, at least for a while, a spirit loftier than tribalism. But this fervour lacked as yet clear guidance, lacked even the courage of conviction. The peace which followed the European War is one of the most significant moments of ancient history, for it epitomizes both the dawning vision and the incurable blindness, both the impulse toward a higher loyalty and the compulsive tribalism of a race which was, after all, but superficially human. 2. The Anglo-French War. One brief but tragic incident which occurred within a century after the European War may be said to have sealed the fate of the first men. During this century, the will for peace and sanity was already becoming a serious factor in history. Save for a number of most untoward accidents to be recorded in due course, the party of peace might have dominated Europe during its most dangerous period, and through Europe the world, with either a little less bad luck or a fraction more of vision and self-control at this critical time, there might never have occurred that eon of darkness in which the first men were presently to be submerged. For had victory been gained before the general level of mentality had seriously begun to decline, the attainment of the world state might have been regarded not as an end, but as the first step toward true civilization. But this was not to be. After the European War, the defeated nation, formerly no less militaristic than the others, now became the most pacific and a stronghold of enlightenment. Almost everywhere, indeed, there had occurred a profound change of heart, but chiefly in Germany. The victors, on the other hand, in spite of their real craving to be human and generous, and to found a new world, were led partly by their own timidity, partly by their governor's blind diplomacy, into all the vices against which they believed themselves to have been crusading. After a brief period in which they desperately affected amity for one another, they began to indulge once more in physical conflicts. Of these conflicts, two must be observed. The first outbreak, and the less disastrous for Europe, was a short and grotesque struggle between France and Italy. Since the fall of ancient Rome, the Italians had excelled more in art and literature than in martial achievement. But the heroic liberation of Italy in the 19th Christian century had made Italians peculiarly sensitive to national prestige. And since among Western peoples national vigour was measured in terms of military glory, the Italians were fired by their success against a rickety foreign domination to vindicate themselves more thoroughly against the charge of mediocrity in warfare. After the European War, however, Italy passed through a phase of social disorder and self-distrust. Subsequently, a flamboyant but sincere national party gained control of the state and afforded the Italians a new self-respect based on reform of the social services and on militaristic policy. Trains became punctual, streets clean, morals puritanical. Aviation records were won for Italy. The young, dressed up and taught to play at soldiers with real firearms, were persuaded to regard themselves as saviours of the nation, encouraged to shed blood, and used to enforce the will of the government. The whole movement was engineered chiefly by a man whose genius in action combined with his rhetoric and crudity of thought to make him a very successful dictator. Almost miraculously, he drilled the Italian nation into efficiency. At the same time, with great emotional effect and incredible lack of humour, he trumpeted Italy's self-importance and her will to expand. And since Italians were slow to learn the necessity of restricting their population, expansion was a real need. Thus it came about that Italy, hungry for French territory in Africa, jealous of French leadership of the Latin races, indignant at the protection afforded to Italian traitors in France, became increasingly prone to quarrel with the most assertive of her late allies. It was a frontier incident, a fancied insult to the Italian flag, which at last caused an unauthorized raid upon French territory by a small party of Italian militia. The raiders were captured, but French blood was shed. The consequent demand for apology and reparation was calm, but subtly offensive to Italian dignity. Italian patriots worked themselves into short-sighted fury. The dictator, far from daring to apologize, was forced to require the release of the captive militiamen and finally to declare war. After a single sharp engagement, the relentless armies of France pressed into North Italy. Resistance, at first heroic, soon became chaotic. In consternation, the Italians woke from their dream of military glory. The populace turned against the dictator, whom they themselves had forced to declare war. In a theatrical but gallant attempt to dominate the Roman mob, he failed and was killed. The new government made a hasty peace, ceding to France a frontier territory which he had already annexed for security. Thenceforth, Italians were less concerned to outshine the glory of Garibaldi than to emulate the greater glory of Dante, Giotto, and Galileo. France had now complete mastery of the continent of Europe. But having much to lose, she behaved arrogantly and nervously. It was not long before peace was once more disturbed. Scarcely had the last veterans of the European War ceased from wearying their juniors with reminiscence, when the long rivalry between France and England culminated in a dispute between their respective governments over a case of sexual outrage said to have been committed by a French African soldier upon an English woman. In this quarrel, the British government happened to be definitely in the wrong, and was probably confused by its own sexual repressions. The outrage had never been committed. The facts which gave rise to the rumour were that an idle and neurotic Englishwoman in the south of France, craving the embraces of a caveman, had seduced a Senegalese corporal in her own apartment. When later he'd shown signs of boredom, she took revenge by declaring that he had attacked her indecently in the woods above the town. This rumour was such that the English were all too prone to savour and believe. At the same time, the magnates of the English press could not resist this opportunity of trading upon the public's sexuality, tribalism, and self-righteousness. There followed an epidemic of abuse and occasional violence against French subjects in England, and thus the party of fear and militarism in France was given the opportunity it had long sought. For the real cause of this war was connected with air power. France had persuaded the League of Nations, in one of its less intelligent moments, to restrict the size of military aeroplanes in such a manner that while London lay within easy striking distance of the French coast, Paris could only with difficulty be touched by England. This state of affairs obviously could not last long. Britain was agitating more and more insistently for the removal of the restriction. On the other hand, there was an increasing demand for complete aerial disarmament in Europe, and so strong was the party of sanity in France that the scheme would almost certainly have been accepted by the French government. On both counts, therefore, the militarists of France were eager to strike while yet there was opportunity. In an instant, the whole fruit of this effort for disarmament was destroyed. That subtle difference of mentality which had ever made it impossible for these two nations to understand one another was suddenly exaggerated by this provocative incident into an apparently insoluble discord. England reverted to her conviction that all Frenchmen were sensualists, while to France the English appeared, as often before, the most offensive of hypocrites. In vain did the saner minds in each country insist on the fundamental humanity of both. In vain did the chastened Germans seek to mediate. In vain did the League, which by now had very great prestige and authority, threaten both parties with expulsion, even with chastisement. Rumour got about in Paris that England, breaking all her international pledges, was now feverishly building giant planes which would wreck France from Calais to Marseille. And indeed the rumour was not wholly a slander, for when the struggle began, the British Air Force was found to have a range of intensive action far wider than was expected. Yet the actual outbreak of war took England by surprise. While the London papers were selling out upon the news that war was declared, enemy planes appeared over the city. In a couple of hours, a third of London was in ruins, and half her population lay poisoned in the streets. One bomb, falling beside the British Museum, turned the whole of Bloomsbury into a crater, wherein fragments of mummies, statues, and manuscripts were mingled with the contents of shops and morsels of salesmen and the intelligentsia. Thus in a moment was destroyed a large proportion of England's most precious relics and most fertile brains. Then occurred one of those microscopic yet supremely potent incidents which sometimes mould the course of events for centuries. During a bombardment, a special meeting of the British Cabinet was held in a cellar in Downing Street. The party in power at the time was progressive, mildly pacifist, and timorously cosmopolitan. It had got itself involved in the French quarrel quite unintentionally. At this cabinet meeting, an idealistic member urged upon his colleagues the need for a supreme gesture of heroism and generosity on the part of Britain. Raising his voice with difficulty above the bark of English guns and the volcanic crash of French bombs, he suggested sending by radio the following message. From the people of England to the people of France, catastrophe has fallen on us at your hands. In this hour of agony, all hate and anger have left us. Our eyes are opened. No longer can we think of ourselves as English merely, and you as merely French. All of us are, before all else, civilized beings. Do not imagine that we are defeated, and that this message is a cry for mercy. Our armament is intact, and our resources still very great. Yet, because of the revelation which has come to us today, we will not fight. No plane, no ship, no soldier of Britain shall commit any further act of hostility. Do what you will. It would be better even that a great people should be destroyed than the whole race should be thrown into turmoil. But you will not strike again. As our own eyes have been opened by agony, yours now will be opened by our act of brotherhood. The spirit of France and the spirit of England differ. They differ deeply, but only as the eye differs from the hand. Without you, we should be barbarians, and without us, even the bright spirit of France would be but half expressed. For the spirit of France lives again in our culture and in our very speech, and the spirit of England is that which strikes from you your most distinctive brilliance. At no earlier stage of man's history could such a message have been considered seriously by any government. Had it been suggested during the previous war, its author would have been ridiculed, execrated, perhaps even murdered. But since those days, much had happened. Increased communication, increased cultural intercourse, and a prolonged, vigorous campaign for cosmopolitanism had changed the mentality of Europe. Even so, when after a brief discussion the government ordered this unique message to be sent, its members were awed by their own act. As one of them expressed it, they were uncertain whether it was the devil or the deity that had possessed them, but possessed they certainly were. That night the people of London, those who were left, experienced an exaltation of spirit. Disorganization of the city's life, overwhelming physical suffering and compassion, the consciousness of an unprecedented spiritual act in which each individual felt himself to have somehow participated. These influences combined to produce, even in the bustle and confusion of a wrecked metropolis, a certain restrained fervour and a deep peace of mind wholly unfamiliar to Londoners. Meanwhile, the undamaged North knew not whether to regard the government's sudden pacifism as a piece of cowardice or as a superbly courageous gesture. Very soon, however, they began to make a virtue of necessity and incline to the latter view. Paris itself was divided by the message into a vocal party of triumph and a silent party of bewilderment. But as the hours advanced and the former urged a policy of aggression, the latter found voice for the cry, "Vive l'Angleterre! Vive l'humanité!" And so strong by now was the will for cosmopolitanism that the upshot would almost certainly have been a triumph of sanity, had there not occurred in England an accident which tilted the whole precarious course of events in the opposite direction. The bombardment had occurred on a Friday night. On Saturday, the repercussions of England's great message were echoing throughout the nations. That evening, as a wet and foggy day was achieving its pallid sunset, a French plane was seen over the western outskirts of London. It gradually descended and was regarded by onlookers as a messenger of peace. Lower and lower it came. Something was seen to part from it and fall. In a few seconds, an immense explosion occurred in the neighbourhood of a great school and a royal palace. There was hideous destruction in the school. The palace escaped, but chief disaster for the course of peace, a beautiful and extravagantly popular young princess was caught by the explosion. Her body, obscenely mutilated but still recognisable to every student of the illustrated papers, was impaled upon some high park railings beside the main thoroughfare toward the city. Immediately after the explosion, the enemy plane crashed, burst into flame, and was destroyed with its occupants. A moment's cool thinking would have convinced all onlookers that this disaster was an accident, that the plane was a belated straggler in distress, and no messenger of hate. But confronted with the mangled bodies of schoolboys and harrowed by cries of agony and terror, the populace was in no state for ratiocination. Moreover, there was the princess, an overwhelmingly potent sexual symbol and emblem of tribalism, slaughtered and exposed before the eyes of her adorers. The news was flashed over the country and distorted, of course, in such a manner as to admit no doubt that this act was the crowning devilry of sexual fiends beyond the Channel. In an hour the mood of London was changed, and the whole population of England succumbed to a paroxysm of primitive hate far more extravagant than any that had occurred even in the war against Germany. The British Air Force, all too well equipped and prepared, was ordered to Paris. Meanwhile, in France, the militaristic government had fallen, and the party of peace was now in control. While the streets were still thronged by its vociferous supporters, the first bomb fell. By Monday morning, Paris was obliterated. There followed a few days of strife between the opposing armaments and of butchery committed upon the civilian populations. In spite of French gallantry, the superior organisation, mechanical efficiency, and more cautious courage of the British Air Force soon made it impossible for a French plane to leave the ground. But if France was broken, England was too crippled to pursue her advantage. Every city of the two countries was completely disorganized. Famine, riot, looting, and above all, the rapidly accelerating and quite uncontrollable spread of disease disintegrated both states and brought war to a standstill. Indeed, not only did hostilities cease, but also both nations were too shattered even to continue hating one another. The energies of each were for a while wholly occupied in trying to prevent complete annihilation by famine and pestilence. In the work of reconstruction, they had to depend very largely on help from outside. The management of each country was taken over for the time by the League of Nations. It is significant to compare the mood of Europe at this time with that which followed the European War. Formerly, though there had been a real effort toward unity, hate and suspicion continued to find expression in national policies. There was much wrangling about indemnities, reparations, securities, and the division of the whole continent into two hostile camps persisted, though by then it was purely artificial and sentimental. But after the Anglo-French War, a very different mood prevailed. There was no mention of reparations, no possibility of seeking security by alliances. Patriotism simply faded out, for the time, under the influence of extreme disaster. The two enemy peoples cooperated with the League in the work of reconstructing not only each one itself, but each one the other. This change of heart was due partly to the temporary collapse of the whole national organization, partly to the speedy dominance of each nation by pacifist and anti-nationalist labor, partly to the fact that the League was powerful enough to inquire into and publish the whole story of the origins of the war and expose each combatant to itself and to the world in a sorry light. We've now observed in some detail the incident which stands out in man's history as perhaps the most dramatic example of petty cause and mighty effect. For consider, through some miscalculation or a mere defect in his instruments, a French airman went astray and came to grief in London after the sending of the peace message. Had this not happened, England and France would not have been wrecked. And had the war been nipped at the outset, as it almost was, the party of sanity throughout the world would have been very greatly strengthened. The precarious will to unity would have gained the conviction which it lacked, would have dominated man, not merely during the terrified revulsion after each spasm of national strife, but as a permanent policy based on mutual trust. Indeed, so delicately balanced were man's primitive and developed impulses at this time, that but for this trivial accident, the movement which was started by England's peace message might have proceeded steadily and rapidly toward the unification of the race. It might, that is, have attained its goal before, instead of after, the period of mental deterioration, which in fact resulted from a long epidemic of wars. And so the first dark age might never have occurred. 3. Europe after the Anglo-French War. A subtle change now began to affect the whole mental climate of the planet. This is remarkable since, viewed for instance from America or China, this war was, after all, but a petty disturbance. Scarcely more than a brawl between quarrelsome statelets, an episode in the decline of a senile civilization. Expressed in dollars, the damage was not impressive to the wealthy West and the potentially wealthy East. The British Empire, indeed that unique banyan tree of peoples, was henceforward less effective in world diplomacy. But since the bond that held it together was by now wholly a bond of sentiment, the empire was not disintegrated by the misfortune of its parent trunk. Indeed, a common fear of American economic imperialism was already helping the colonies to remain loyal. Yet this petty brawl was, in fact, an irreparable and far-reaching disaster. For in spite of those differences of temperament which had forced the English and French into conflict, they had cooperated, though often unwittingly, in tempering and clarifying the mentality of Europe. Though their faults played a great part in wrecking Western civilization, the virtues from which these vices sprang were needed for the salvation of a world prone to uncritical romance. In spite of the inveterate blindness and meanness of France in international policy, and the even more disastrous timidity of England, their influence on culture had been salutary, and was at this moment sorely needed. For poles asunder in tastes and ideals, these two peoples were yet alike in being on the whole more sceptical, and in their finest individuals more capable of dispassionate yet creative intelligence than any other Western people. This very character produced their distinctive faults, namely, in the English, a caution that amounted often to moral cowardice, and in the French, a certain myopic complacency and cunning, which masqueraded as realism. Within each nation there was, of course, great variety. English minds were of many types, but most were, to some extent, distinctively English, and hence the special character of England's influence in the world. Relatively detached, sceptical, cautious, practical, more tolerant than others, because more complacent and less prone to fervour, the typical Englishman was capable both of generosity and of spite, both of heroism and of timorous or cynical abandonment of ends proclaimed as vital to the race. French and English alike might sin against humanity, but in different manners. The French sinned blindly through a strange inability to regard France dispassionately. The English sinned through faint-heartedness and with open eyes. Among all nations they excelled in the union of common sense and vision. But also among all nations they were most ready to betray their visions in the name of common sense. Hence their reputation for perfidy. Differences of national character and patriotic sentiment were not the most fundamental distinctions between men at this time. Although in each nation a common tradition or cultural environment imposed a certain uniformity on all its members, yet in each nation every mental type was present, though in different proportions. The most significant of all cultural differences between men, namely the difference between the tribalists and the cosmopolitans, traversed the national boundaries. For throughout the world, something like a new cosmopolitan nation with a new all-embracing patriotism was beginning to appear. In every land there was by now a salting of awakened minds who, whatever their temperament and politics and formal faith, were at one in respect of their allegiance to humanity as a race or as an adventuring spirit. Unfortunately, this new loyalty was still entangled with old prejudices. In some minds, the defence of the human spirit was sincerely identified with the defence of a particular nation, conceived as the home of all enlightenment. In others, social injustice kindled a militant proletarian loyalty which, though at heart cosmopolitan, infected alike its champions and its enemies with sectarian passions. Another sentiment, less definite and conscious than cosmopolitanism, also played some part in the minds of men, namely loyalty towards the dispassionate intelligence and perplexed admiration of the world which it was beginning to reveal, a world august, immense, subtle, in which seemingly man was doomed to play a part, minute but tragic. In many races there had no doubt long existed some fidelity toward the dispassionate intelligence, but it was England and France that excelled in this respect. On the other hand, even in these two nations there was much that was opposed to this allegiance. These, like all peoples of the age, were liable to bouts of insane emotionalism. Indeed, the French mind in general, so clear-sighted, so realistic, so contemptuous of ambiguity and mist, so detached in all its final valuations, was yet so obsessed with the idea France as to be wholly incapable of generosity in international affairs. But it was France, with England, that had chiefly inspired the intellectual integrity which was the rarest and brightest thread of Western culture, not only within the territories of these two nations, but throughout Europe and America. In the 17th and 18th Christian centuries, the French and English had conceived more clearly than other peoples an interest in the objective world for its own sake, had founded physical science, and had fashioned out of scepticism the most brilliantly constructive of mental instruments. At a later stage, it was largely the French and English who, by means of this instrument, had revealed man and the physical universe in something like their true proportions, and it was chiefly the elect of these two peoples that had been able to exult in this bracing discovery. With the eclipse of France and England, this great tradition of dispassionate cognizance began to wane. Europe was now led by Germany, and the Germans, in spite of their practical genius, their scholarly contributions to history, their brilliant science and austere philosophy, were at heart romantic. This inclination was both their strength and their weakness. Thereby they had been inspired to their finest art and their most profound metaphysical speculation. But thereby they were also often rendered unself-critical and pompous. More eager than Western minds to solve the mystery of existence, less sceptical of the power of human reason, and therefore more inclined to ignore or argue away recalcitrant facts, the Germans were courageous systematizers. In this direction they had achieved greatly. Without them, European thought would have been chaotic. But their passion for order and for a systematic reality behind the disorderly appearances rendered their reasoning all too often biased. Upon shifty foundations they balanced ingenious ladders to reach the stars. Thus, without constant ribald criticism from across the Rhine and the North Sea, the Teutonic soul could not achieve full self-expression. A vague uneasiness about its own sentimentalism and lack of detachment did indeed persuade this great people to assert its virility now and again by ludicrous acts of brutality, and to compensate for its dream life by ceaseless, hard-driven, and brilliantly successful commerce. But what was needed was a far more radical self-criticism. Beyond Germany, Russia. Here was a people whose genius needed even more than that of the Germans, discipline under the critical intelligence. Since the Bolshevik Revolution, there had risen in the scattered towns of this immense tract of corn and forest, and still more in the metropolis, an original mode of art and thought, in which were blended a passion for iconoclasm, a vivid sensuousness, and yet also a very remarkable and essentially mystical or intuitive power of detachment from all private cravings. America and Western Europe were interested first in the individual human life, and only secondarily in the social whole. For these peoples, loyalty involved a reluctant self-sacrifice, and the ideal was ever a person excelling in prowess of various kinds. Society was but the necessary matrix of this jewel. But the Russians, whether by an innate gift or through the influence of age-long political tyranny, religious devotion, and a truly social revolution, were prone to self-contemptuous interest in groups. Prone indeed to a spontaneous worship of whatever was conceived as loftier than the individual man, whether society or God or the blind forces of nature. Western Europe could reach by way of the intellect a precise conception of man's littleness and irrelevance when regarded as an alien among the stars, could even glimpse from this standpoint the cosmic theme in which all human striving is but one contributory factor. But the Russian mind, whether orthodox or Tolstoyan or fanatically materialist, could attain much the same conviction intuitively by direct perception, instead of after an arduous intellectual pilgrimage, and reaching it could rejoice in it. But because of this independence of intellect, the experience was confused, erratic, frequently misinterpreted, and its effect on conduct was rather explosive than directive. Great, indeed, was the need that the West and East of Europe should strengthen and temper one another. After the Bolshevik Revolution, a new element appeared in Russian culture, and one which had not been known before in any modern state. The old regime was displaced by a real proletarian government, which, though an oligarchy, and sometimes bloody and fanatical, abolished the old tyranny of class and encouraged the humblest citizen to be proud of his partnership in the great community. Still more important, the native Russian disposition not to take material possessions very seriously cooperated with the political revolution and brought about such a freedom from the snobbery of wealth as was quite foreign to the West. Attention, which elsewhere was absorbed in the amassing or display of money, was in Russia largely devoted either to spontaneous instinctive enjoyments or to cultural activity. In fact, it was among the Russian townsfolk, less cramped by tradition than other city dwellers, that the spirit of the first men was beginning to achieve a fresh and sincere readjustment to the facts of its changing world. And from the townsfolk, something of the new way of life was spreading even to the peasants, while in the depths of Asia, a hardy and ever-growing population looked increasingly to Russia not only for machinery, but for ideas. There were times when it seemed that Russia might transform the almost universal autumn of the race into a new spring. After the Bolshevik Revolution, the new Russia had been boycotted by the West and had therefore passed through a stage of self-conscious extravagance. Communism and naive materialism became the dogmas of a new crusading atheist church. All criticism was suppressed, even more rigorously than was the opposite criticism in other countries. And Russians were taught to think of themselves as saviors of mankind. Later, however, as economic isolation began to hamper the Bolshevik state, the new culture was mellowed and broadened. Bit by bit, economic intercourse with the West was restored, and with it, cultural intercourse increased. The intuitive mystical detachment of Russia began to define itself, and so consolidate itself, in terms of the intellectual detachment of the best thought of the West. Iconoclasm was harnessed. The life of the senses and of impulse was tempered by a new critical movement. Fanatical materialism, whose fire had been derived from a misinterpreted but intense mystical intuition of dispassionate reality, began to assimilate itself to the far more rational stoicism which was the rare flower of the West. At the same time, through intercourse with peasant culture and with the peoples of Asia, the new Russia began to grasp in one unifying act of apprehension both the grave disillusion of France and England and the ecstasy of the East. The harmonizing of these two moods was now the chief spiritual need of mankind. Failure to integrate them into an all-dominant sentiment could not but lead to racial insanity, and so in due course it befell. Meanwhile, this task of integration was coming to seem more and more urgent to the best minds of Russia, and might have been finally accomplished had they been longer illumined by the cold light of the West. But this was not to be. The intellectual confidence of France and England, already shaken through progressive economic eclipse at the hands of America and Germany, was now undermined. For many decades, England had watched these newcomers capture her markets. The loss had smothered her with a swarm of domestic problems such as could never be solved save by drastic surgery. And this was a course which demanded more courage and energy than was possible to a people without hope. Then came the war with France and a harrowing disintegration. No delirium seized her such as occurred in France. Yet her whole mentality was changed, and her sobering influence in Europe was lessened. As for France, her cultural life was now grievously reduced. It might indeed have recovered from the final blow had it not already been slowly poisoned by gluttonous nationalism. For love of France was the undoing of the French. They prized the truly admirable spirit of France so extravagantly that they regarded all other nations as barbarians. Thus it befell that in Russia the doctrines of communism and materialism, products of German systematists, survived uncriticized. On the other hand, the practice of communism was gradually undermined, for the Russian state came increasingly under the influence of Western and especially American finance. The materialism of the official creed also became a farce, for it was foreign to the Russian mind. Thus, between practice and theory, there was, in both respects, a profound inconsistency. What was once a vital and promising culture became insincere. 4. The Russo-German War. The discrepancy between communist theory and individualist practice in Russia was one cause of the next disaster which befell Europe. Between Russia and Germany there should have been close partnership, based on interchange of machinery and corn. But the theory of communism stood in the way, and in a strange manner Russian industrial organization had proved impossible without American capital. And little by little this influence had transformed the communistic system. From the Baltic to the Himalayas and the Bering Straits, pasture, timberlands, machine-tilled cornlands, oil fields, and a spreading rash of industrial towns were increasingly dependent on American finance and organization. Yet not on America. But the far less individualistic Germany had become in the Russian mind the symbol of capitalism. Self-righteous hate of Germany compensated Russia for her own betrayal of the communistic ideal. This perverse antagonism was encouraged by the Americans, who, strong in their own individualism and prosperity, and by now contemptuously tolerant of Russian doctrines, were concerned only to keep Russian finance to themselves. In truth, of course, it was America that had helped Russia's self-betrayal, and it was the spirit of America that was most alien to the Russian spirit. But American wealth was by now indispensable to Russia. So the hate due to America had to be borne vicariously by Germany. The Germans, for their part, were aggrieved that the Americans had ousted them from a most profitable field of enterprise, and in particular from the exploitation of Russian Asiatic oil. The economic life of the human race had for some time been based on coal, but latterly oil had been found a far more convenient source of power. And as the oil store of the planet was much smaller than its coal store, and the expenditure of oil had, of course, been wholly uncontrolled and wasteful, a shortage was already being felt. Thus, the national ownership of the remaining oil fields had become a main factor in politics and a fertile source of wars. America, having used up most of her own supplies, was now anxious to compete with the still prolific sources under Chinese control by forestalling Germany in Russia. No wonder the Germans were aggrieved. But the fault was their own. In the days when Russian communism had been seeking to convert the world, Germany had taken over England's leadership of the individualistic Europe. While greedy for trade with Russia, she had been at the same time frightened of contamination by Russian social doctrine, the more so because communism had at first made some headway among the German workers. Later, even when sane industrial reorganization in Germany had deprived communism of its appeal to the workers, and thus had rendered it impotent, the habit of anti-communist vituperation persisted. Thus the peace of Europe was in constant danger from the bickering of two peoples who differed rather in ideals than in practice. For the one, in theory communistic, had been forced to delegate many of the community's rights to enterprising individuals, while the other, in theory organized on a basis of private business, was becoming ever more socialized. Neither party desired war. Neither was interested in military glory, for militarism as an end was no longer reputable. Neither was professedly nationalistic, for nationalism, though still potent, was no longer vaunted. Each claimed to stand for internationalism and peace, but accused the other of narrow patriotism. Thus, Europe, though more pacific than ever before, was doomed to war. Like most wars, the Anglo-French War had increased the desire for peace, yet made peace less secure. Distrust, not merely the old distrust of nation for nation, but a devastating distrust of human nature, gripped men like the dread of insanity. Individuals who thought of themselves as wholehearted Europeans feared that at any moment they might succumb to some ridiculous epidemic of patriotism and participate in the further crippling of Europe. This dread was one cause of the formation of a European confederacy in which all the nations of Europe, save Russia, surrendered their sovereignty to a common authority and actually pooled their armaments. Ostensibly, the motive of this act was peace, but America interpreted it as directed against herself and withdrew from the League of Nations. China, the natural enemy of America, remained within the League, hoping to use it against her rival. From without, indeed, the Confederacy at first appeared as a close-knit whole, but from within it was known to be insecure, and in every serious crisis it broke. There is no need to follow the many minor wars of this period, though their cumulative effect was serious both economically and psychologically. Europe did at last, however, become something like a single nation in sentiment, though this unity was brought about less by a common loyalty than by a common fear of America. Final consolidation was the fruit of the Russo-German War, the cause of which was partly economic and partly sentimental. All the peoples of Europe had long watched with horror the financial conquest of Russia by the United States, and they dreaded that they also must presently succumb to the same tyrant. To attack Russia, it was thought, would be to wound America in her only vulnerable spot. But the actual occasion of the war was sentimental. Half a century after the Anglo-French War, a second-rate German author published a typically German book of the baser sort. For as each nation had its characteristic virtues, so also each was prone to characteristic follies. This book was one of those brilliant but extravagant works in which the whole diversity of existence is interpreted under a single formula, with extreme detail and plausibility, yet with amazing naivete. Highly astute within its own artificial universe, it was nonetheless in wider regard quite uncritical. In two large volumes, the author claimed that the cosmos was a dualism in which a heroic and obviously Nordic spirit ruled by divine right over an unself-disciplined yet servile and obviously Slavonic spirit. The whole of history and of evolution was interpreted on this principle, and of the contemporary world it was said that the Slavonic element was poisoning Europe. One phrase in particular caused fury in Moscow: the anthropoid face of the Russian subman. Moscow demanded apology and suppression of the book. Berlin regretted the insult, but with its tongue in its cheek, and insisted on the freedom of the press. Followed a crescendo of radio hate and war. The details of this war do not matter to one intent upon the history of mind in the solar system, but its result was important. Moscow, Leningrad, and Berlin were shattered from the air. The whole west of Russia was flooded with the latest and deadliest poison gas, so that not only was all animal and vegetable life destroyed, but also the soil between the Black Sea and the Baltic was rendered infertile and uninhabitable for many years. Within a week the war was over, for the reason that the combatants were separated by an immense territory in which life could not exist. But the effects of the war were lasting. The Germans had set going a process which they could not stop. Whiffs of the poison continued to be blown by fickle winds into every country of Europe and Western Asia. It was springtime, but save in the Atlantic coastlands, the spring flowers shriveled in the bud, and every young leaf had a withered rim. Humanity also suffered, though save in the regions near the seat of war, it was in general only the children and the old people who suffered greatly. The poison spread across the continent in huge blown tresses, broad as principalities, swinging with each change of wind. And wherever it strayed, young eyes, throats, and lungs were blighted like the leaves. America, after much debate, had at last decided to defend her interests in Russia by a punitive expedition against Europe. China began to mobilize her forces, but long before America was ready to strike, news of the widespread poisoning changed her policy. Instead of punishment, help was given. This was a fine gesture of goodwill, but also, as was observed in Europe, instead of being costly, it was profitable, for inevitably it brought more of Europe under American financial control. The upshot of the Russo-German War, then, was that Europe was unified in sentiment by hatred of America, and that European mentality definitely deteriorated. This was due in part to the emotional influence of the war itself, partly to the socially damaging effects of the poison. A proportion of the rising generation had been rendered sickly for life. During the 30 years which intervened before the Euro-American War, Europe was burdened with an exceptional weight of invalids. First-class intelligence was on the whole rarer than before, and was more strictly concentrated on the practical work of reconstruction. Even more disastrous for the human race was the fact that the recent Russian cultural enterprise of harmonizing Western intellectualism and Eastern mysticism was now wrecked.